Okay, so it's number, I think tonight is number 15, but it's certainly part two of Kedushas Hashem, which is the third bracha. Just sit down for that. Oh, can I use that? Is that good? Yeah. So third bracha in the Shmona Esrei, which is Kedushas Hashem. And this is where we got to now. We've already discussed quite a bit of material to do with this bracha. Hopefully tonight we can get through the rest of it. Yes.
The narrative.
Oh, that's right. But Ezra Shem, we're learning in the merit of Refuah Shlema for Elimelech, Yehoshua Aaron, Ben Devorah Rivka, should have Refuah Shlema Bekarov. All right, so well, we can catch up. We'll just catch up. We'll catch up. So, Atah Kadosh, V'shimcha Kadosh, U'kdoshim B'chanim Lucha Sela. That's what we're talking about. And last time we ended up, if you remember, discussing the different things which praise Hashem's name. Don't you remember that? Do you remember that? We'll just give you a little bit of a recap. Does anyone here, for 10 points, can they list any of the four things that we were talking about that praises Hashem's name? Go for it.
Human beings.
Human beings, praise Hashem's name. Give me something else. Give me another creature that prays willingly with Bechira, as it were. Angels. They openly want to praise Hashem's name. Good. So humans and angels. Angels usually wait for humans to finish and then they do their job. What other kind of thing?
Dead people.
Neshamas that have lived a life on this world, their neshama is in the soul world, their body is rotting in the grave. Those neshamas who have lived for a turn, a cycle in this world, also praise Hashem from their abode in Olam HaNeshamas. What else? Excellent. The neshamas in Guf, in Shemayim, which is a repository for as yet unborn souls. Those particular souls have not yet been associated with a human fetus. And because they've not been associated with a human fetus, they are in a different place in Shemayim to those that have. And those souls too praise Hashem from their particular place, which is not Olam HaNeshamas, it's a different place called Guf, awaiting their go round in this world. Excellent.
Sorry, can I just ask, are there any others left? I thought that
Yes, if there's none left, the Mashiach will come.
I
That's one of the.
thought
No.
all this had
Majority.
been
Nope, not at all. Not at all. Now, that's why, by the way, Jews are endured to have many children. The faster we pull those down from Shemaim, the quicker the Mashiach comes. That's such an idea. Indeed, the Gro, the Vilna Gaon, said if he had the power, he would repeal Rabbeinu Gershom's Gezeira, which Ashkenazim specifically took on, not to marry more than one wife. He said that Jews have always married more than one. Yemenites still do. They marry many wives. The more wives that you would have, the Vilna Gaon says, a man should marry as many women that would take him. And the answer is, it's because the more children that you have, the faster the souls from Guf would be depleted. Once those have all had their go round, the Messiah will come.
So we can
Now,
pass that
you're right that the Kabbalists have told us that from a Messiah, from a tradition, that the vast majority of us contain elements or we are in entirely recycled components waiting to fix up previous goes round. That does not mean that new neshamas are not trickling down into the world as well. They must be. Otherwise, the world would simply, it would not just continue only to wrap up the recycling. There must be some chiddush still coming in. Yeah, it's a very good question you're asking there. Do I have a backing for that? Yeah, there's a Zohar Kodesh that discusses this, but I can't remember where it is. And I do remember hearing this, B'Shem Rabbi Yaakov Hillel, who gave a shmooze in Yeshivas Or Samech on Asar B'Tavis, discussing that.
Does this include all souls of all religions?
No, I don't know. I don't know. From what I understand, it's just Jews. Because the souls for Jews are in a different repository now for the souls for Gentiles. Didn't used to be like that. When was the big change? Matan Torah. When the Gentile souls finally put the line down and rejected their part in being centrally involved in the rectification of the universe. Therefore, the Jewish soul and Gentile soul really had a differentiation at that point. Before that point, truthfully, what was a Jew? Before Matan Torah, what was a Jew? We were all called B'nai Israel. We were descendants of a particular clan. But we weren't the Israelite. We weren't Jews as we know them. So much so that I heard Rabbi Badil once say that if you go back in a time machine to the first ever Pesach Seder, I'm talking the first ever Pesach Seder, which was in Egypt, Could you imagine? Could you just, sorry, I'm going off. I don't have a bell to go off. What? Thank you. Thank you very much. What a Pesach Seder that would be. Imagine sitting round Moshe and Aaron's family table. When they're telling the Haggadah over, they're the characters. And I went to Pharaoh. I told him, if you don't believe me, you can ask your Uncle Aaron. And he wouldn't listen to it. I mean, these are the people. Could you imagine sitting at that Seder? Imagine sitting at that Seder. If you were there, you couldn't eat a thing. Nothing's kosher enough for you. You're sitting round the Seder table of Moshe Rabbeinu and Aaron HaKohen, Miriam and Aviah's around, there's all the families there. It's nowhere near kosher for you.
Not because of the laws of kosher.
Remember, Shavuos, one of the reasons we all have milchiks.
Yeah, so
no. If you go back in a time machine,
you'd say, excuse me,
I'm sorry, but this isn't kosher enough for me because I'm now bound by the laws of the Torah. Yeah. That's why they went all kushering their kalim on Shavuos. They didn't realize basar b'chala was an issue. They had to kush their kalim so we don't have fleishiks because there was no fleishik pos. They realized, oh my gosh, everything we've got is treif. They didn't know. They had to wait till they get the Torah. So therefore, the second Pesach Seder that ever happened, which was in the Midbar, that's kosher mahadrin. There you can eat, eyes closed, because they got the Torah, and now they're keeping the Torah. But if you went back to the first Pesach Seder, wouldn't be good enough for you. So, all right, so we're talking about these four creatures which praise the Kodesh Baruch Hu in and of their own volition. I'm not talking about the fact that in Perek Shira, it does discuss that animals and the elements have a pasuk, which is related to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And indeed, there is a Shnei Luchos HaBris, which being the Zohar Kodesh, saying that when the leaves hit against the corn in the field and they rattle, they sing a particular song, as it were, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's how our inanimate objects also praise Hashem. Yosef utilized this concept when he tapped the chalice and then got the brothers to sit according to age in front of him. Now, what they were so amazed with was that's a totally inanimate object that you make your own sound from. But plants and things like that do praise the Kodesh Baruch Hu, but not like the souls of people and angels, which are much higher order level. We're not talking about that. We can't compare that. I say there's lots of different things. Aliens, if they're aliens. Yechezkel, they're 18,000 worlds. Let's say they doven as well. All very nice, but the four main things which praise the Kodesh Baruch Hu are what we listed. And the most important thing, the biggest praise, comes from human beings, which is an ashama attached to a physical body, which is alive in Olam Hazeh, which is alive in this world. No praise is greater than a praise that's coming from a human being. So much so, everything else has to be pushed aside for that. And if you even wanted to undo the most incidental, not thought about prayer of a human being, you'd have to have the Kohen Gadol in the Beis HaMikdash on Yom Kippur, davening to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, saying, please don't listen to the prayers of wayfarers, to undo that, as we discussed last time. He said he didn't have an umbrella and he was getting wet. In the meantime, if a Kodesh Baruch Hu turns off the rain because they're getting wet in Eretz Yisrael, he might be turning off the rain in effect in the panasa of the farmers that live there. The Kohen Gadol says, don't listen to such tefillahs. And the only time that he has the power to do that is at the most awesome time of the year, the most awesome and holy person of the year, in the most awesome place of the year. The concept of Olam, Shana, and Nefesh, place, time, and person, all coinciding at the greatest level of Kedushin. Only then can he undo the most trivial of prayers of a human being. So we see what tremendous Koyach Hashem has given us in the fact that he's asked us to daven to him and who we are. The Malachim, as it were, have to stand aside. They're really low down on the list. They're number four. We're number one. So the Malachim, you can think about it. It's amazing. Okay. Now what we're going to discuss is this. This is all to discuss the word Ukdoshim b'chol yom yahalucha selah. And holy ones praise you every day. And we were saying, what's Kedoshim? Well, we're talking about Kedoshim. We're talking about people who daven to Kodesh Baruch Hu. We're talking about neshamas who have been here and are davening to Kodesh Baruch Hu in Shemaim. We're talking about neshamas that have as yet not come down to earth. And we're talking about the Malachim. These are called the Kedoshim. These are the ones that have attained the semblance of Kedusha. And all they do all day is praise you incessantly. And that's one of the praises we give to Hashem in this 14-word bracha, the shortest bracha here, number 3 in the Shemona Esrei. Now, let's continue our depth on this concept of Kedoshim b'chol yom. So, one of the things is that the holy ones who praise Hashem every day, we've said it's these four creatures. But the Abu Draham says, actually, you could technically say it's only the Jewish people who were called a Goy Kadosh, a holy nation, as they are exhorted to be holy. They're told to be holy. Indeed, if we open a Chumash, which is neatly prepared here. Thank you. Is over here. Parshas Kedoshim in Sefer VaYikra in Leviticus, chapter 19, Yud Tes. It says, Dabet al kol adas b'nei Yisrael, speak to the entire assembly of the children of Israel, va'amarta aleihem, and say to them, Kedoshim to you, you shall be holy. Why? Ki kadosh ani Hashem alekeichem. Because I am holy, the Lord your God. Because I'm holy, I expect you to aspire to the concepts of Kedusha. Now, you might say, well, that's us then, right? That's talking about us. He's telling us to be holy. You've got to be a Goy Kodesh. You've got to be a holy nation. We've got to be holy. So it's Kedusha. B'chol Yom is us. Alternatively, it could refer to the Melochim. Just the Melochim. They're holy beings, and they sing songs of praise to Hashem daily. And Rabbeinu Yehuda ben Yakar says that these Kedoshim are the souls of the righteous upon whom God's name rests after they depart from the physical world, and who praise Hashem incessantly. So we're getting all different sources to say where these creatures are, which this creature is. Now, in that pasuk that I just quoted, which is Vayikra Yud Tes Beis, which is Leviticus 19:2, the Bereishis Rabbah says on Tzadi Beis, which is chapter 90.2, one might think equal to me, where it says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, you're holy because I'm holy. So what's the holiness we're aiming for? What's the holiness we're aiming for? It sounds like you're aiming for Hashem's holiness. You should be holy because I'm holy. So what are you after? You're after becoming as holy as him. But there's an obvious difficulty. Do we need a pasuk, a verse, to inform us that we aren't as Kadosh as Hashem and we need to elevate ourselves? Isn't that understood? What did we say Kedusha was, by the way? Just a little bit of revision. Last time we defined, what does the word Kodesh mean? Does anyone remember what we said? What does holy mean? Someone says to you, oh, that's a very holy book. What does holy mean? Define holy. What's holy? In English. Translate holy into English.
Something that it's connected to, Hashem.
That's a very deep Kabbalistic answer. Can you just give me a... That's true.
Elevated?
A spiritually elevated.
Separated, removed, yeah. And designated for something spiritual. Separated and removed. When we give Kodshim, we've got to give to the Kohen, right? We've got to give Truma. Truma Gedola has to go to the Kohen from fruits and vegetables that are grown in the land of Eretz Yisrael. We have to take a tithe and give it to the Kohen. He's holy, so we separate out a holy bit. We have to give Maaserishin to the Levi. Then he has to give Trumas Maaser, also from what he got to the Kohen, right? Because that's elevated material, and the Kedusha of the land goes onto the product. And on the seventh year, Shavuos, they get an additional level of Kedusha as well, which devolves onto the actual food. So what is the designation of Kedusha? It's separated, removed, elevated, designated material. The ultimate level of separation, the ultimate level of elevation, the ultimate level of designation is Hashem himself. There's nothing more separate than him, because he is not in any way bound or attached to anything else but himself. So why do I need a pasuk saying you should be holy to me? Well, I know that I'm not holy. I need to know that I'm not as Kodesh and I should aspire? It's like this. I think the Medrash is saying like this. The Kedusha of the Jewish people, as Leon was saying, is similar to God's Kedusha, but parallel as a separate entity in and of itself. We're holy and we're able to emulate God. But no, our Kedusha is not similar to God's. It's a product of, an outgrowth of, an emanation of God's own Kedusha. Because my holiness is above yours, says the Medrash Rabbah. It's not a statement of degree, but a description of origin. My holiness is the source of all Kedusha. If you want Kedusha, as Leon says, you've got to tap into my Kedusha. That's the only way in. And by the way, the Auschwitz HaKadosh says, that's the root of all anti-Semitism. Like, what? Har Sinai, Mount Sinai, says Gemara Shabbos, is Har Sinai. It's the mount of hatred. Sinner is hatred in Hebrew. Sinai and sinner are homonyms almost, right? The mount of hatred. Why? Says the Al-Shech HaKadosh, once HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave the Torah to the Jewish people, He made a spiritual monopoly. And the only way to get into him now is the way the Torah says, finished. Which means all other methods of gaining Kedusha are null and void. And the Gentile world doesn't like that. Because they want to get Kedusha their way. They would, but my way, I'll get it, but I don't have to go through the Jews. I don't want to do that. I don't have to do what the Torah says. And therefore, the mount of hatred that the Torah was given on, Mount Sinai, is Mount Sinai, right? The mount of hatred is because once you have been separated, you're closing the doors to any other way. And people don't like that. People want a revolving door any way I like. You know, it's, this is the way I'm doing it. It doesn't work like that anymore. Because they said no, and Hashem said, fine, this is the way we're going to do it. This is the only way to do it. And that causes anti-Semitism. Because it makes an absolute, singular line of Kedusha only available through Torah and mitzvahs. Everything else won't work. Because you can't get his holiness. And he's the only source of holiness. And the only way he's made his holiness available is the way he said. Your holiness emanates from mine, says Hashem in the Medrash. Wow. It's a bard. It's Parsha. It's to do with the Parsha. It's the hail. Which is above yours and is the source of your Kedusha. Now, in this respect, Ata Kadosh, Veshimcha Kadosh, you alone, God, are holy, and your name alone is the only way into that Kedusha. And all other, quote-unquote, holinesses is a mere emanation of yours. The only way, remember we discussed what a name is last time? Sometimes you say a name in order that someone turns around, and if I were to describe you very carefully, people wouldn't know who you are unless I said a name. The only way to chap onto Hashem, as it were, is to grab his name. That's how we call out to him. Wherever you call out his name, he'll be there. But what's a name? It's just a handle in order to be able to get, like a teacup has a handle because the teacup is too hot. So you have a handle to grasp the main thing. A name is a handle. Indeed, in modern computing terms, a name is also called a handle. A handle is something which you grasp onto to get something else. Hashem's name is something you utilize to get closer to him. Here's two important points. This is a write down, this is a think about it point. This is the key of what this Medrash is saying. It's the Medrash Rabbah Tzadi Beis, 92. Number one, this is a conclusion. Nothing in Bria, nothing in creation has intrinsic Kedusha. You will not be able to go anywhere. That's why, by the way, Jews do not collect holy relics. Have you noticed that? Other religions are full of relics. The holy this, the holy that, the holy blanket, the holy dog collar, the holy pair of trainers worn by St. Martin as he went jogging, and they're enshrined and put in glass boxes in temples. We don't do that. Why don't we do that? Because nothing in Kedusha is intrinsically holy. Nothing. All Kedusha is conferred upon physical entities as an emanation of God's Kedusha that flows in total to that entity. So if you'd have a pen, there's no intrinsic Kedusha in a pen, but if you use it to write Lashon Hara against someone or stab a lady in the eye with, that's making the pen unholy or ignoble. If you decide to write Chidushei Torah or a letter to someone who's not feeling well to make them happier, you're utilizing the pen for something Kedusha. It's a mitzvah. So the pen gets moved to the side of Kedusha. But what does that mean? It means it gets moved closer to what God would want you to do with that physical object than what he wouldn't want you to do with that physical object. Number two, the second concept is that the Kedoshim, the holy ones, upon which Hashem's holiness rests, must be B'chol Yom, says the Bracha. Every day. Now what's this every day? Not just every day, but B'chol Yom, in all of every day. You've got to be committed. You've got to be committed. It's got to be of every moment, every day. That's how you find Kedusha. You can't say, look, right now, if I want the status of a Ish Kodesh, of a holy man, you can't say, look, right now I'm going to write this letter and I'll write beautiful words to someone who's unwell and it'll make him feel better, let's say. Then I'll go and stab Tracy in the eye with a pen, the same pen. Well, you're not Ish Kodesh. You may have done something good with the pen and now you're doing something bad. That doesn't devolve Kedusha upon you. You've done a mitzvah, but you've also done a levera with the same order. You've got to be committed and focused in your closest to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's B'chol Yom, says the Bracha. Your name is holy, and those who are holy, You could read it all day, they bless you incessantly, but those who are holy all of every day, comma, they bless you incessantly. That's who blesses you incessantly. That's a bigger cover, by the way, for Hashem. It's a much bigger cover to Hashem to say the people who praise you are people who are full-time committed in that particular cause. That's a bigger... Remember, the first three brachas are praising Hashem. Bracha number four onwards is asking for requests. So Atachon and Ladas, what we're going to talk about, that's actually asking for something. Here we're praising Hashem. So what's the biggest praise? It's not just saying those who are holy praise you. It's those who are holy who are really... They're really holy people. They're really holy things. They're full-time. They're professional holy things. And that's who praises you. That's a much bigger praise of Hashem. He says, listen, I got someone here who's like a... He's a part-time fan. He's a part-time fan. Every Thursday, he's on my side, but the rest of the week, I don't know, he supports another god. And he praises me on Thursday. That's not such a big thing for Hashem. You're not saying that's such a great thing for a king, you know what I mean? No, he's a part-time subject. He's a part-time subject. He's not fully committed. Those who are Kaddish are fully committed, and they praise Hashem all day. That's something to praise Hashem with. That's what B'chol Yoy means. They're constantly holy. Every facet of existence, every moment of existence is infused with Hashem's godliness. Now, that type of behavior results in and of itself in their praising Hashem. An individual that keeps doing that will naturally come to praise Hashem in having a close relationship with him based on a deep recognition of him. Kedusha cannot, therefore, be fragmented. It must be an ongoing concept affecting every action and pursuit. That's what the Torah informs us in Devarim Zion Yud Beis. V'haya Ekiv Tishmu'un. What does that mean? The end result of Torah observance is the realization of the covenant with Hashem, which is an eternal bond with the source of all Kedusha. What are you doing? What is this concept? What is this great convocation that we're making? When you do the mitzvahs, you gain an everlasting bond with me, says Hashem. And I'm the source of all Kedusha. That's not in bits. You don't get a bit of Hashem. Once you tap into Hashem, you tap into everything. He's all one, right? You can't tap into a concept of that. Once you're tapping anywhere, as we're about to discuss, you're tapping into everything. Now, I have here a motherboard, a computer motherboard, which is the heart of a computer, basically, the main bit of it. And it was kindly donated to me by PC Doctors, Mendel and Moshe at PC Doctors in Prestwich, opposite Haber's, your one-stop shop for all computing solutions. Thank you very much, Mendel. Thank you very much, Moshe. Here it is. And what I want to discuss here is the fact that there's lots and lots of components on a board. Lots and lots of components. So how do you make a motherboard? How do you make a motherboard? It's very interesting. It's worth doing this just for 1 minute because we get a tremendous moshel out of this. Get a big piece of plastic and cover the whole thing in copper. So you've got a square of plastic with a sheet of copper on the top. Then you print out a circuit diagram of all these lines that you see on a piece of plastic. Piece of plastic. You put that plastic on there and you pull off any of the plastic that isn't on the circuit line. So you've basically got a sheet of plastic, a sheet of copper, and then a sticker made up of plastic of what it is you want the circuit to be. Then you take the whole thing and you dip it in a really strong acid. And it eats away all the copper that isn't protected by the plastic. Then you take it off and wash it off, and then you pull away all the plastic covering, and you're left with the copper on the plastic plate that's going to become the trace for the electricity to go through. And that's how you make a printed circuit board. Now you've got the base, and then what you do is you have these robots that come along and stuff all these components on the board. Now, certain components here are quite expensive. You'd think they're the most important. So this one here is the central processing unit. This is the brain of the computer. And those are all the switches that go on and off. And that's in there. That could cost you £70-80 just for this little cube and this little square here, right? Just that bit. Then you've got the other bit. Let's look at under here, under this bit here. It's called a chipset. And under there, that's also really important because that talks to that, right? So these are expensive bits. And then you've got other big bits and cards and things or whatever and capacitors here. But if you look really closely, there's hundreds of tiny little film resistors. Teeny. If you see these little dots everywhere, teeny little things stuffed in there. Mm-hmm. You see that? Now those you buy in a bag of 50 for about 70p. Which means individually they don't have any real monetary value. You agree with that, right? I mean, I know you had split up 50 into 70p, you know what I mean? How many pennies is that? It's going to be less than a penny. Now, if I came along to your computer, you're sitting there very nicely minding your own business, doing an email, finding out how someone is. And I came up, just walked in with a pair of pliers, opened up your computer. Computer's running. I take a long nose pair of pliers, needle nose pliers. Just go, oh, it's so cheap, you don't need this. Just go in there and just pull that straight off. The smallest, most valueless component on your motherboard. Put it in a little bag and say, evening, and walk off. Would you be happy about that?
No.
Why not?
Because it wouldn't work. Nothing would work.
But I haven't done you any... There's no... I can't take it to Bastien for anything less than a shove of prutter, right, which is an eighth of a gram of refined silver at current market value, which is approximately 5.5p. I think we worked out recently, right? Just less than 5.5p. It's not even a legal theft. Do you know what I mean? Why are you upset with me? It's less than 5p. It's less than a penny. Answer is, that component somehow is vital for the functioning of the entire unit, because otherwise they wouldn't have put it there. Is that true? Does that make sense? I mean, do you know what I mean? If I come into the bonnet of your car, take out one little teeny screw, that little screw, and you've got to drive down to London, would you feel comfortable? It's only one teeny little screw. It's not like I took out the engine or the belt or something like that. I just want one screw. Right, there's a reason somehow that the designer, when they designed the flow of the chip, they said we're going to need a resistor just there. Even though the resistor's almost worthless, monetarily it's like posh worthless. That's not the point. It has a function doing something just there. And this whole thing becomes defective without it. That's the moshel. That is the analogy. Here's the nimshel. Here's the point of the moshel. A motherboard, the actual line of the motherboard, gives place, purpose, and function to all the components. I.e., we know that the chip goes there, because if you look on the back, they've designed the whole thing around the chip. Can you see that? I mean, that's why it's got to go there, because when we're drawing the original circuit diagram, that's where everything goes. Does that make sense? And these bits have to go there, because I want that there, and all these bits, yeah, we've worked this all out. We worked it out. So the motherboard gives place and purpose and function for all the components. But it's the components that do the job. Is this like sounding real? The components are the mitzvahs. Each mitzvah. Now, some mitzvahs are quote-unquote expensive. They're big. They're important. They're valuable to us. Could you give me any ideas of big, like CPU-level mitzvahs? Shabbos, okay, that's a very good one. Let's call Shabbos the CPU. Kashrus. Crisps. I'm sorry. Crisp. I look that way. I just think crisps. I'm sorry. Bris Mila, very good. For a man, Bris Mila. Taharis Mishpacha, family purity. Those like they used to say Shabbos, Kashrus, Taharis Mishpacha. That's the triangle of Judaism. Right? But what about things like building a makkah? Building a parapet around a flat roof. That's a derisive mitzvah. If you have a flat roof, you've got to build a fence around it, a balustrade, lest health and safety, chas v'shalom, someone could fall off. That's a Torah mitzvah. That's a Torah mitzvah. Now, would you think that's the CPU unit?
No.
Because look, not everyone does it. Not everyone has a flat roof. Not everyone needs to do it. So it's not that important, right? I've got news for you. Without every single one of the components on the board doing their thing, the whole thing is somehow chaser. The whole thing is missing something. Now, what's the motherboard itself? The Torah. The Torah gives place, function, and purpose. And what is the motherboard? Over here, I'm just going to look for it very quick. Over here, you plug the power into the motherboard. So it actually goes into a PSU, and that's plugged into the mains. PSU power supply unit, and then the energy goes into it. And when that energy goes into it, the electricity flows across all of these thousands of lines. When you learn Torah, you're technically attaching yourself to the energy that flows across all the components. That's why it says Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam. the learning of Tyre is equivalent to them all. Why? Because the energy flows like water across the entire trace. All the copper lines are filled with this energy. Even if at that particular point in time, this particular resistance is fine, because I'm not sending the email. The fact is, it's still connected to the energy flow, even though now it's not Pesach, and we're not having to eat and chomp matzahs. If you're learning about Pesach, it's connected to the whole Jewish year. Yes, you're only physically doing it in Nissan. That's true. But even though it's not Nissan at the moment, I'm connected to it because the Torah flows across this whole thing as one unit. So even though I'm not using that particular capacitor now because I'm not sending that particular email, I'll need that there because without that there, the whole thing doesn't work even now. You can't have a Torah without Pesach, even if, let's say, a guy never lives to Nissan. Let's say a guy's born in a particular year or whatever and he knows he's not going to make the next Pesach. That's when he shouldn't learn Hilchos Pesach. It's irrelevant. If he's attached to the concept of the halacha, you're attached to the whole Torah. Why am I telling you any of this? It's a question you may have been thinking while you sit there so well. The answer's like this. The bond that we have with Hashem is affected, as Rashi comments for High Akev, in the name of the Medrash, if you, says Hashem, observe the mitzvahs kalas, the light, seemingly less weighty, less important, quote-unquote, minor mitzvahs, that people tend to tread on, the akev is the heel, people tend to tread on those mitzvahs. Not so bothered about that. Give me the big one, Shabbos, Kashrus. But the little ones, not so important. Or if you make the observance total and non-discriminating, I'll keep Pesach with as much gusto as I do the parapet around my roof. It doesn't matter. It's a way to get close to you, because I'm seeking to get close to Hashem. Then when I recognize that as a bond to Hashem, all the mitzvahs are equally significant and equally important. Yes, the most expensive mitzvah is probably Pesach. Probably. I don't know. Maybe Pesach.
We don't know which one.
Now, that's true. Now, you're right. We don't know exactly which... We don't know which one is which. You're right. We can't go and know Shabbos is really the CPU. We don't... But there are clues. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has told us certain mitzvahs are like you're keeping the whole Torah. Shabbos is... He has said that. Also, another one is, wherever there's more laws guarding something, we know it's more important that you shouldn't trip up over it. For instance, I always like to give the thing, if like... do you know by Heaton Park, there's a sewage plant? Mm-hmm. There's a sewage plant by Heaton Park. There's a fence around the sewage plant. Why? Nobody should go in there if you don't need to. When I went, I went to near Sellafield, went to a place called Drigg Beach. Drigg Beach, if you're ever there, it's really worth going to Drigg Beach. There is a skeletonized shipwreck on the beach. And you can walk around the shipwreck on the beach. It's like a long, eroded shipwreck. But that beach is right in front of Sellafield Nuclear Facility. Now, Sellafield Nuclear Facility, there are fences all around, controlled nuclear zone. We saw armed police officers just patrolling in the grassy areas by the beach because they use it as a dump for nuclear waste in that area, and they got to guard it. Why have they got to guard it? Because it's dangerous, and maybe a terrorist will come in and want some of that and make a bomb out of it, you know, whatever. The point is, the more that we see guardianship, the more we know something important is there. The more the Torah laces and fences loads and loads of halacha around something, it must be that's more important in and of itself. Not in absolute terms, if you want to say everything's connected, but in and of itself as a function, like Shabbos and Kashrus, they've got loads of laws surrounding them in different ways. Why? There's lots and lots of rules. As you can see, there's lots of... Right, look at that. I mean, there's tons and tons and tons of connections that you have to make to have that happen. To make Shabbos happen, there's tons of connections to make. All the 39 melachos and everything about that, kashrus, loads and loads of it. But with Makir, as long as you've got a flat roof and you make a fence around it, you're good to go. So that's one solder drop there. You know what I mean? Now, do you understand? So we don't really know, but we can deduce certain concepts. But we don't really know. Hail.
It's rain.
So the only way you're going to achieve Kedusha is by saying the little ones and the big ones don't really matter to me. Whatever mitzvah I've got to achieve my bond with you right now, I'm going to go for that. That's the concept, right? Now, we conclude the bracha, Baruch Ata Hashem, HaKael HaKadosh. Blessed are you, Hashem, the Holy God. Oh, what's going on here? So much here. The third blessing, as I said last time, corresponds to Yaakov Avinu. The first one was Avram Avinu, the tremendous chesed that he did. The second one was Gevurah, the might, the ultimate might that we're ever going to experience or see is Techias HaMesim. And the ultimate individual that embodied that concept was Yitzhak Avinu. And now we're talking about Yaakov Avinu somehow, although he's obviously not mentioned, like in the first bracha. I got so much. The Shibalei HaLeket cites the Medrash, which says that when Yaakov Avinu approached the heavenly gates of mercy in Bereshis Chof Ches Yud Zayin, when he went to Daven at Beis El, and he sanctified the name of Hashem, the ministering angels chanted Baruch Ata Hashem HaKael HaKadosh. That's an angelic bracha, which we've taken for ourselves. The angels recited that bracha to Hashem, and we now take that because we like that kind of thing. I have to go. I'm going off. I believe it's worth it. I think, thank you. Thank you very much. I'm going off. Parshas Vayechi, Yaakov Avinu is giving brachas to all of his children. And Yosef comes in with his children, which are the only children as yet in the family that were born outside the land of Eretz Israel. They're born in Golas. And their name was Menasseh and Ephraim. So, I'll just sit down. I'll be Yaakov Avinu for a second. If I'm sitting here. Well, now, what he wanted to do, Yosef was, let's say, where Leon is sitting, right? And he wanted to bring his two children in front of me to give me a bracha. Yeah, so far so good. Does this make sense? Mm-hmm. So he placed Menasseh, who is the oldest, to my right, so that my right hand can go on his head. And Ephraim, who is the younger, to the left to get the left hand for the blessing. What he did was, he's sitting up, right? He crossed his hands and he put his right hand on Menasseh's head. Sorry, on Ephraim's head. Mm. And he put his left hand on Menasseh's head. Yeah, the famous thing. Yosef was particularly perturbed. He said, no, not so, Father. Not so. This one is the older. He gets the right hand. And he was physically manhandling his father's hands to correct them and put them right. And Yaakov Avinu says these words, Yadati Bani, Yadati. I know, my son. I know. We've got to talk about this. Says the Medrash Rabbah. What did he mean? He said, I know, my son, what happened with Reuven and Bilhah. I know, my son, what happened with Yehuda and Tamar. My Inyan Shmita, what's this got to do with the price of fish? What's that got to do with it? We're talking about an older boy and a younger boy. The older boy is entitled to the older bracha. The young boy gets the littler bracha and get on with it. What are you telling me about this family history? I don't need to discuss this now. Do you hear that? That here come like a question? Unbelievable. Yeah. Father. Their nanny is the last day of year to Yaakov Avinu's life. They're in Egypt. Father, this has already happened. It's like this. What did Reuven do? Reuven messed around with Yaakov Avinu's sleeping quarters. Because after Rachel died on the way, Yaakov Avinu liked Rachel so much that he decided to move his quarters to Bilhah's tent, who was the handmaiden, actually the sister, believe it or not. All Bilhah and Zilpah were sisters, all from Laban. They're all daughters. He married four sisters, technically, right? So Bilhah and Zilpah are also daughters of Laban, but of different wives. Rachel and Leah were from a superior wife. And the lesser wife gave birth to Bilhah and Zilpah. And they became handmaidens to Leah and Rachel, respectively. So Zilpah went to Leah and Bilhah went to Rachel. So when Rachel died, and he loved Rachel very, very much, he went to reside in Bilhah's tent. Now this was still while Leah was alive. And Reuben, who was the firstborn son of Leah, was most perturbed at the gross indignity he perceived as an insult to his mother, that he should move his sleeping quarters to his other wife's handmaiden prior to moving his bed into a wife proper. So he disconcerted the beds and he moved the beds around. Some say he tried to entice Bilhah and get her not to like Yaakov Avinu anymore so that she would reject him and he would have to go back to Leah. This was a sin which was intensely, intensely infuriating to Yaakov Avinu, and he cursed the anger, the impetuous behaviour of Reuven, and he lost the firstborn rights over this action. And he devolved that over to Yehuda. The Malchus went to Yehuda, and the Gadlus, the firstborn right, really went over to Yosef. Okay, what's going on with Yehuda and Tamar? The whole thing with Yehuda and Tamar, really, he could have married her with Levirate marriage, but he didn't want to because Ur and Onan died. And once you have a woman who is widowed twice, there's a machlokas in Sanhedrin what to do with her. Certainly a woman who has three husbands who have all passed away, you're not allowed to marry. You're not allowed to marry such a woman because we're scared that a pattern has been set up within this woman's neshama, that the previous husbands are still, as it were, struggling with her neshama spiritually. It could lead to the premature death of another husband. So a woman who has been widowed three times is not marriageable. But there's a Shiloh, what about twice?
You could be the third.
Oh, what about if a woman has married two men and both those men have passed away? There's a question, maybe you shouldn't marry her either. Now that Tamar has been married to Ur and Onan and both the husbands have passed away, he was in doubt over this law as to whether or not anyone else, another son, should marry her. And therefore, he kind of pushed her off, as it were, and kept like delaying things and not talking to her. And one thing led to another, and she ended up a spinster. You know what I'm saying? Or unmarried, an unmarried woman. So she, as it were, put on a veil, and she went there, and he was enticed by her, as it seems, actually, not the case at all. She went there to say, who's next, my Ibn? I'm legally obligated to marry someone. He also was completely correct. He's a kinsman who's a redeemer. He didn't know who she was, and they had a child together. Twins, actually. Amazing concept. Okay. It was at that time, by the way, that, you know, he ran away because of what happened with Yosef. He ran away and went to start a business. He was a mayor of a town, and Yaakov and all the brothers said, you know what, let's go get Yehuda back. Let's go get him back. And they got Yitzhak Avinu in as well. So Yitzhak Avinu and Yaakov Avinu, says the Medrash, all went down to visit Yehuda because I know he's a very important man. Let's bring him back to the family. Let's get him back. That very day is when they came in saying there's a prostitute who you've cleaned up the town of prostitutes. There's a prostitute who is pregnant. And he said, take her out and burn her. Take her out and burn her. And she didn't say anything. She could have said, it's you. She just said, whoever this staff and cloak belong to is the father. Now, he could have said, I don't know who that is. And that's it. And get rid of it. We learn out from that, it is better to jump into a furnace of fire than to embarrass someone in public. Because she didn't. What a tremendous tzedakus. Yehuda was in front of his old family. He's a political head. He's a mayor. And he could have got away with it. And he said, she's more righteous than I. And he so was embarrassed, he turned green. So much so that in the Choshen Mishpat, which is the breastplate worn by the Kohen Gadol, the stone that represents Yehuda is jade, green. You've got to be willing to turn green to tell the emes. And because the Choshen Mishpat atones for sins done in judgment, we learn out all the middos that a dayan should have, a judge should have. And the truth is one of the middos that a judge should have is like Yehuda, that is willing to turn green to admit and tell the truth. Always tell the truth. That's his job. So Yehuda, this was a stain, as it were, on Yehuda, it seems. Says Yaakov Avinu to Yosef when he's crossing his hands. And this is the brocha of Yaakov Avinu. Don't lose sight of that. Yadati b'ni yadati. I know, my son. I know about what happened with Reuven. I know, my son. I know what happened with Yehuda. So what? What's that got to do with Ephraim and Manasseh? Says like this. Yaakov Avinu was afraid of something. He feels as if there is a negative family trait which has developed in the people of Israel. If you look at Avraham Avinu's children, he had two children. Who were his children? His main children. Who were his children?
Yaakov.
Avraham Avinu.
No,
who
Yitzhak,
were?
Yitzchok
and Yishmael. Who's older? Yishmael is older. Yitzchok had two children. Who are they? Who's older? Yaakov and Esav. Who's older?
Esav.
So what happens to the oldest? Not good stuff, right? When he had children, he had the oldest. Who was his Yaakov's oldest?
Reuben
was his oldest. But then when Reuben made a mistake and he gave it over to Yehuda, what happened to Yehuda?
Not good.
He's starting to see a problem. The oldest child, or the child that has the status of the oldest, has a problem. And their spirituality somehow has a pagam in, and I'm worried about that. So when Manasseh, who's the older, and Ephraim were placed in front of him, he foresaw that the older child may have more spiritual challenges than the younger child. So he crossed his hands to give the spiritually more active bracha, the right hand, to the younger, and gave the spiritually less active bracha to the older. But why then didn't he just move them around, asks the Mesher Chochma. If I'm sitting down, and I've got these two in front of me, and I'm doing this. You know what? So take Ephraim, who you are, and move him for ease to your right. Take Manasseh and move him to your left, and just give him the bracha, says the Mesher Chochma. The feet are involved as well.
What?
When you get a bracha from a tzaddik, it's not just from the hands. It's from the feet as
left
well.
And right.
Left and right. The feet have 10 toes. The hands have 10 fingers. Each one for the 10 emanations of Hashem. But you've got lower emanations and upper emanations. Explains the Mesher Chochma as follows. When you get a bracha from a foot of a tzaddik, that's for gashmias. That's for physicality. When you get a bracha from the hands, that's for ruchnias. That's for spirituality. When Yaakov Avinu crossed his hands, giving the stronger bracha of the right hand to Ephraim, he gave him the weaker leg, which means you aren't going to be as rich. When he gave the weaker bracha to Manasseh, he gave him the stronger leg, the right leg, which means he'll have more money in life. Listen to this. He says that he knows that the secret to Klal Yisrael is Achdus. Oneness and togetherness. When we're together as a team, we are poshut, unstoppable. You cannot stop Klal Yisrael when they're together as a team. But there could be infighting. There could be infighting. Listen to the wisdom of Yaakov Avinu, how he gave a bracha. He said like this. If I move Manasseh and Ephraim out so my hands are straight, that means one side's going to get the best of the ruchnias and the best of the gashmias. And the other side's going to get the weaker ruchnias and the weaker gashmias. What did he do? He crossed his hands. Which means Ephraim got the better spiritual bracha, but the weaker physical bracha. While Manasseh got the weaker spiritual bracha, but the stronger physical bracha. Those two won't be jealous of each other. Think this through. You got a guy who's got a tremendous bracha for doing Torah mitzvahs. But panasa, not so easy. You got another guy, standard Joe, doesn't excel in Torah mitzvahs. He doesn't, but doesn't excel. But Bo Hashem, guns fine. He's living quite nicely, thank you very much. Who's envious of who? Think this through. The one with a big bracha for the ruchnias, he's very happy. Baruch Hashem is learning. But he's not envy. His brother, who is living very nicely, Baruch Hashem, but he isn't learning Torah mitzvahs. So he realizes, you know what? We've got to do. The other brother is like, look, I'm not as big in learning and Torah mitzvahs as him, but Baruch Hashem, you know what I mean? I wouldn't want. So therefore, there's no friction. There's no friction because he crossed his hands. He crossed the circuit. Why? To make sure Ephraim and Menashe get on with each other. That's why he says Ephraim and Menashe will be Keruven and Shimon. 724 is equal to 725. From a Manasseh, 724 is equal to Reuven and Shimon, which is 725. We learn out from that that one number with only one difference is exactly the same in Gematria. Ephraim and Manasseh will be like Reuven and Shimon, who were born tribes. They're now going to be elevated to the level of their uncles. They're going to be tribes in Israel, clans in Israel as well. But yet you're your nephews. We always bless our children. They should be Ephraim and Manasseh, because you shouldn't just be like me. You should be on the level of your uncles. Be a door up. And you shouldn't fight with each other. Ephraim and Manasseh didn't fight with each other because they were like one unit. Sometimes they were counted separately as Ephraim and Manasseh whenever Levi wasn't counted. But if Levi was counted, they were just counted together as Shevet Yosef. That's how close they were. They were inseparable in certain counts. They were just considered the tribe of Yosef. We learn out from that they had the most achdus. They were together. Says Yaakov Avinu, when the Klal Yisrael are going to grow up, he said, in time, the people of Israel will bless their children by these two alone. And on Friday night, we say, may Hashem make you like Ephraim and Manasseh. What does that mean? He's going to make you on a level where you can ascend in greatness, which usually never happens. You always say, you read a Sedaris. Every generation goes down a bit. Hey, this generation popped up. They became clan leaders even though they were only the kids. Two is, there's such togetherness because each one has a bracha which is strong in one week in another. Therefore, there's no intrinsic jealousy and hatred. That's what I want for my kids too, says Yaakov Avinu. You, these two will be the blessing of all Israel. And that's what he said to Yosef. Yadati bani, yadati. I know, my son. I know what I'm doing. Let me do this. I've got to infuse a certain thing with these two because they're unique. They're born in Golas. And even they're born outside the land of Eretz Yisrael, in this kind of environment, they're still as good as the clan heads such as Yehuda, Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yisachar, Dan, Naphtali, Gad. They're just as good as that. This is awesome. I know what I'm doing, says Yaakov Avinu. And that's why Yosef capitulated and allowed him to do that, because the super brocha that they're going to get is going to be a bracha of togetherness, oneness, and it's going to be well balanced for the generations. This is just an insight into the power of Yaakov Avinu's epitome of Kedusha. He understood that. And this is evidenced by the fact that unlike Avraham and Yitzhak, all of Yaakov's children were righteous. Therefore, the third patriarch, Yaakov Avinu, forged the Jewish people into one indivisible unit, fulfilling King Solomon's statement in Mishlei Daled Yudbeis, Ecclesiastes 4:12, a three-ply cord is not easily severed. Once you twine three filaments together, it becomes a very strong rope. A chut meshulash, this, when you take three cords, that becomes a strong rope. Once you've got Avraham and Yitzhak, that's two, that's strong. But once you get three, it's much stronger than the sum of its parts. A three-ply cord now becomes really useful. It's Yaakov Avinu who has to put that final seal on because he's the greatest Ish Kodesh there is. He's even more Kodesh, it seems, than Avraham and Yitzhak. And how to understand how he achieved such heights above Avraham and Yitzhak, we have to understand is a basis of his balance. And we're going to talk about the balance of his harmony and the beauty of Tiferes next time. I look forward to seeing you then. And Be'ez Hashem, we should all have inspired.